The manipulation that is most frightening is either A, a compromise at the tabulator level, or an intercept between the subtabulators and the master tabulator. And all of those are well-established and well-demonstrated hacks at a master level, but they're not particularly sophisticated. And then down at the individual voting machine level, yes, you have all kinds of failures, compromises, and errors that occur all the way down to that level. But my concerns are generally up in the network, but I'm a network engineer, so that's what I think about.
Now, with the tabulation, it seems, as you've said in the past, that most of these elections have fallen in favor of the GOP.
By a shockingly bizarre percentage, whenever the exit polls seem to be wildly at odds with the outcome, it seems to always favor the GOP, which, you know, sometimes that's a candidate I supported, but frankly, I don't care if my candidate wins as much as I care about being in a democracy. Either I am or I am not in a country that elects its leaders. That's what I want. And if my party is elected, great. And if my party is not elected, great. I still live in a democracy.
Okay, so based on your expertise and your experience, why do you think that's happening?
Because people are frauding the system. If the statistics that you saw and regularly see in outcomes of wildly variable, like the famous Connolly anomaly in Ohio 2004, that statistical anomaly, which is, as several statisticians have studied, mathematically into the multi-millions to one possibility, anomalies at one-tenth of that process in the credit card space instantaneously launch an investigation. So we know somebody's playing with the numbers. They're stealing something or forcing balances. It's like when you see those kind of absurd results where you can tell mathematically things are out of whack, either something failed or something was defrauded. They don't happen.
There's no way that what you have seen in previous elections could happen by accident.
I don't believe it.
And you're saying that if something like that did happen and you were an elections official or a secretary of state, what would you do?
Arrest people.
So do you believe that there should be a criminal investigation
based on
what's happened in the past?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been very upfront about this for a while. I personally think that Georgia in 2002, the Senate race was stolen. I think Ohio was stolen in 2004.
How do you think Ohio was stolen in 2004?
At the tabulator level.
In the tabulator level?
The Connolly anomaly is just impossible. And if you look, it was brilliantly done. It appears what's known as a force balancing equation is incoming, heavily Democratic precincts reported how much Kerry was ahead in those precincts. A number of counties would then flip the number, total number of voters ended up being probably nearly correct or approximately correct, but basically they would just flip Bush and Kerry votes, but only the place that Bush was already winning, so a place that Bush would have won by 54 or 56% and ends up winning by 66% or 67%. Meanwhile, a bizarre down ballot event, you have this woman 7 pages into the ballot who never campaigned in southern Ohio, who never assumed a black Democrat from Cleveland, ends up getting more votes than Kerry does. Because they weren't flipping her votes, so a person who voted a straight Democratic ticket, that number that she has, I just simply don't believe there are literally tens of thousands of Bush voters in southern Ohio who also wanted to support an extremely liberal black judge from Cleveland. It just boggles the mind that these two numbers would line up. Boggles it.
One of your colleagues from Ohio, Mike Connell, has been instrumental in helping to set up a lot of these tabulator situations. Can you just talk about Mike Connell and the role that he plays in this, and if he were to be ever questioned by anybody, what role would he have as a witness?
I can't answer that question. I know Mike, and I like Mike. Mike and I share a lot of values. I have spent a great deal of time and energy and effort working on democracy and free speech advocacy around the world. Mike has spent a great deal of time on religious freedom and free speech around the world, and those areas intersect. And Mike and I have attended conferences together and supported each other in projects focused on that. Now, Mike is also a devout Catholic. I am a spiritual believer in a very open sense, but I'm not of a particular denomination in the way he is. And Mike is also much more of a partisan than I am. And while we intersect on those things and have worked on those things, Mike has been involved certainly in building the front ends, the website and application ends, of many of the same people that I would have concerns and would like to talk to.
I know that Mike Connell set up and created the Election Day website for Ken Blackwell in 2004, and there's been a lot of questions about the tabulator results going to a GOP server in Chattanooga, Tennessee, run by a company called Smart Tech. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, as it's been reported to me, what was supposed to happen was, yes, Mike was involved in building Ken Blackwell's front end, the web access, the way people would actually access the site. What was supposed to happen is each of the counties would tabulate their vote. Those tabulators were reporting to the Secretary of State's office, to the master tabulator. The master tabulator would then report information to the system Mike designed. So it's all gotten there. And then if the buffer, meaning so many people want to see the results at once that it overloaded or nationally, there was an overflow site, which was supposed to be outsourced to this company, Vine Smart Tech, that was supposed to look at it. That's the way it was initially described as happening. Fine. But what appears electronically, and what now increasingly, although apparently nobody can find the records of the contracts, what actually happened is the tabulators sent their results to Smart Tech in Chattanooga, who then sent the information on to the Secretary of State, who then put it into my system. Well, back to my conversation about these two computers talking to each other and people can do things with the data in between. If the tabulators, with anonymously compiled results, are sending their results to Smart Tech, and Smart Tech can change the results and then send them on to the Secretary of State, and ta-da, you have the Connolly anomaly. It explains how it happened.
Let's talk about another company in Ohio, Triad. It's run by
the Rat family.
Could you talk about them and their role in tabulators and possible problems with elections?
Okay. I will speak about an unnamed bank in an unnamed country, and I'll explain why this is important. Unnamed bank in an unnamed country suddenly had a very public event where the bank was failing, and people realized a lot of money was gone. Somebody stole it. Did they steal it by going in and holding up a gun? No, they stole it electronically, and where it also appeared, it appeared either the board member or the president or the chairman was the person who stole the money. So in this unnamed country, with this unnamed bank, my firm and some colleagues I was working with were brought in to see if we could help solve this problem for a lot of people who were very upset. And we arrived to find out that someone at the top had ordered the removal of the hard drives of several computers just before we arrived. And in one case, we managed to track down and recover those hard drives. Anytime a functioning computer system has the hard drives stripped out in a banking investigation, literally, in the case of the U.S., the Secret Service and company come in with guns drawn because clearly people are stealing stuff and then trying to run away with the evidence. After Ohio in 2004, the Green Party demanded a recount, and all of a sudden this little company that almost no one had focused on, that I had been yelling about for a year before the election, called Triad, had people driving in Ohio, pulling hard drives out of some tabulator saying they had to put in clean hard drives, make sure the recount had clean programming. That is a lie. There is only one reason that would occur. There is something on the code in that hard drive, if forensically investigated, would have shown that there was different numbers on a local tabulator than what was reported at the state, or alternately, there was additional code on that tabulator that was talking to another computer to get results sent to it. Those are the only two explanations that make any sense. And in any kind of real investigation world, any kind of fair justice process, the moment hard drives are being yanked out of machines that have been done with a tabulator, or been done with banking, or been done with mathematical work, someone's covering something up.
So, do you believe that?
Yes.
That the Rat family was covering something up.
Yes.
Do you believe that they were involved in tabulation manipulation or just destruction of?
They'd be the first people I would talk to.
Okay. So, have they ever been talked to, you know, by any law enforcement officials?
There were a couple of local articles that I saw in Ohio papers that some county officials began questioning why these things are being changed. And certainly in one case, apparently the FBI did indeed either begin a case or open a case or talk to some people, but I have no idea where they went. That would be a question for Jennifer Bruner or somebody in the FBI office in Columbus. That's beyond my... I'm an architect. I'm telling you how it does it in financial services. Certainly, if I pick up the phone and say one of my clients is currently stripping hard drives out of a computer and we have a concern about an anomaly, I can assure you they'll all be arrested in minutes. Okay. But not if it's a tabulator. Oh, it's just a tabulator. It's like, well, it's no big deal. We're just doing a recount for the Green Party. We have to change our hard drives. Who believes that? Who at home has ever said, you know something? I got a recount, you know. I'm going to redo my taxes. But I'm going to put a new hard drive to make sure it's right. It's like... now, it's absurd on the face.
I know you talked about your religious beliefs, and but...
Well, I avoided talking about my religious beliefs. It's not the relevant issue.
I know, but in the past you've made some statements about... It seems like a lot of the people who have been implicated in election manipulation...
Every time I go and investigate a problem that I think is a problem, on my own time, with my own money, at personal expense, or personally, professionally, and financially, I end up finding out, frankly, that there's these very extremist religious people programming the computers.
So,
fundamentalist Christians are very good programmers, but they all would definitely have a political agenda. Within the Republican Party, I'm much more in the old sort of, it's totally unpopular, but I actually think one of the best presidents of the last 30 years was Nixon. Why? Well, the Clean Water Act and the EPA, which of all the things that have happened in the last 30 years, probably have the most important legacy for the long-term survivability of America. Those are the kind of Republicans I like. Sure, he was a little paranoid and probably shouldn't have hired plumbers to break into things. That's a bad thing, but the good things he did, I think, are pretty extraordinary. And I'm willing to be that out there. We don't really have too many of those kind of members of the GOP anymore. We seem to have a very odd mix now of people who don't believe there's any role for government, and I think the government has a very important role in a society. I think it should be minimal, but I think it's important. Instead, we have these people who believe the government should be moral enforcers of a variety of religious moralities, but they should then somehow not be involved in social structures that are beneficial. So you sort of have the Grover Norquist drowning the bathtub guys over here, and you have these people who say, save the babies and own the Supreme Court over here, and that seems to be the audience. And it seems that most of the people programming the tabulators, whenever I see a problem, it turns out they're a bunch of the save the babies people.
Now,
maybe it's just a coincidence.
Are the Rat family of that ilk?
I certainly believe so.
What about this upcoming election? What recommendations do you have?
Paper ballots.
For protecting this?
Paper ballots. Okay. I've been saying it. I'll keep saying it. Paper ballots. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I reach out to my fellow citizens. I say, look, we're still an incredibly gracious people, all of us. And we have an enormous capacity to be gracious. But if we're going to be a great democracy, we've got to get an assurance that people who are, and yes, okay, I am a little too scientific, and yes, I think the world is older than 6,000 years, but I also really know what I'm talking about with network assurance, and that's why your credit card is running today. Okay, I'm telling you these systems can't, by design, be fixed, but here's the way they do it in Great Britain. Everyone goes to the poll, They fill out a ballot on paper. They take the ballots locked in boxes with several people from each party supervising it. Anyone from the public who wants to come can go along. They go into banks because everyone trusts bank tellers. They spread them out, and the bank tellers count them. It takes 10, 12 hours. It costs a few bucks to pay the bank tellers to do it. And then everybody writes the results of each precinct, and they call them in. And you want to know something? Everybody can watch. It's transparent. It works. It's cheap. And per voter, the countries that do it like that, Canada, Germany, Great Britain, they spend less on their elections than we do. And when they're done, they know, they may not like the results of the election, but they know that's who they elected. And you want to know something? Great. If we have paper ballots and tomorrow we elect some guy who believes that a winged flummagus from the stargate's going to come and lead us all to greater salvations or whatever his belief or her belief may be, great. We elected that person. We'll live with it. But we know we actually did that. Right now, I don't believe, nor frankly should anyone with any common sense or small-town values believe, that these machines that your grandmother doesn't know what the heck they are and sets up are reporting out anything other than magic dust.
Do you have any predictions for the upcoming election?
Sure.
What do you think is going to happen?
McCain-Palin. By 51.2%, and a shocking recovery and winning by 3 electoral votes.
And do you believe that that's going to be because of force balancing?
Of course. Now, unless China or Israel decides they'd rather have Barack, I'm not sure. I mean, they have some significant interests here. Or, frankly, you may end up in a situation like down in Florida where you had three precincts that had, you know, in the special election they ran out here recently, only two people on the ballot, candidate A and candidate B. They had about 500 people come in and vote. One candidate got 210 votes, and one candidate got none. And so now they're sitting there in front of a judge saying, whoa, doesn't candidate B, can we assume everybody went in that voting booth, voted for either A or B? They go, well, this is what the machine is telling us, so we have to believe it. Like, I don't believe it. Now, was it a programming mistake? Maybe. Was it an error? Maybe. Was it a machine failure? Maybe. Was it hacking? Maybe. We don't know. No, and we can't know.
There's been reports, you know, to us that maybe there's already been some network set up to manipulate the election in a certain number of states, six or eight.
By which side? Both sides?
Well, I'm just asking you.
I mean, maybe the Green Party is following the women.
I mean, have you...
Bob Barr is interesting technologist.
Do you believe that that's happening or possible, or have you heard anything?
Do I believe it's possible?
I think it's probable.
I think the 25 hours of YouTube video at this point, apparently, with me talking about this, which, frankly, I haven't watched all but about 2 minutes because someone forced me to. Yes, it's possible! This is what I deal with every day, is people setting up, they're called MIMS, called man in the middle. That's the process of attack. We deal with it every day in the credit card space. Somebody will set up a MIM at the end of a mall, all the transmissions coming out of the mall get intercepted, they'll strip out the credit card information they want, they'll make white cards or fraudulent cards, or do card not present charges on the web, and we have to clean it up, find the damn thing, pull it out, and try and track the guys down. I do it every day for a living. And you want to know something? If people think a voting machine that calls into a tabulator somewhere in the county office is any different than all those cash registers calling into the central processor, it's the same thing. And yes, if you put a man-in-the-middle attack, a computer sitting in the middle to change or capture or manipulate the information, it will do so. Is it possible? Yeah.
Is it probable?
Of course.
It's valuable
to be president. There's people out there spending billions trying to become the president. It's valuable. If you can steal it for a couple million bucks, why not?
And do you think that it will happen?
Yes! I don't believe the last two presidential elections were accurately counted or decided. I don't.
So, what other than paper ballots? What should people look for? How can we stop this?
What do you not understand about paper ballots counted by hand by public witnesses? Old technology believe it or not, is the best solution in many cases. And if you want to anonymize the identity, the only way to make electronic voting secure is to not have it be anonymous ballot. If you say, this is my name, Stephen Smore, this is my ballot, and I will assure that it is correct, then you can do that. But then you have the problem of vote buying and retaliation for the way people voted. If you want to have an anonymous vote, you need to have a hardened piece of something of substance to physically not be changeable. Digital information held inside of a circuit and transmitted through a network is inherently changeable, and because it's anonymous, you cannot validate it. Period. No solution exists. Stop it.
So if you are
paper ballots, hand counted. I know. Only thing that works.
I know you've been involved with many criminal investigations and put a lot of bad guys away.
Not many, a few.
That's a few. In this case, what would you, who would you go after in the criminal investigation? When I say who, I'm not exactly saying an individual name, but who in a broader sense.
I have no idea at this point. Frankly, we are collectively guilty of being gadgetitists. We love gadgets. We're addicted to our gadgetry. America is convinced that a technology solution will take care of it. In this case, the technology is paper. It's a great technology. A criminal investigation at this point, I care about getting the democracy back. I want a democracy. I know that when a vote is finished, it's the actual way the people's will was brought forward. At this point, I don't care about a criminal investigation. In fact, the only thing I think is really useful at this point, because you can set up one of these systems, intercept and tear the thing down an hour after the vote is done, and unless you have some very dedicated people at FBI Cyber, there's people who could investigate it, but somebody at the top has to make the decision to put a significant amount of manpower on this, and as far as I know, nobody wants to do that. And frankly, even if they did, it's a huge country. It's a huge country.
But we,
the people, need to make a decision that we want to have a knowable result of our election. And frankly, vox clamatus in deserto, my friend. I have been saying this. In 1998, I went on the record publicly. And I have been on the record every year for a decade about it. Doesn't seem to help.
So realizing the problems that we face in this upcoming election.
Yes.
What would you recommend other to
do you have an absentee process? Do you have a paper ballot? Yeah. Great, go use it. If all of a sudden entire precincts, every single person starts showing up saying, no, I'll take the paper ballot, I want to do absentee, I want to mail in my ballot. Mail-in ballots have a few ways you can be defrauded, but they're a lot safer than an electronic system, and I've looked at both in detail. But what would really be better is if we move back to what worked so well for 190 years, which is people gathering in a central place, putting people that are trustworthy members of your community, your grandmothers and stuff, at a card table. You fill the things out in a booth, you fold it up, or you pull levers that punch a piece of paper. I appreciate that there are some flaws in the way hanging chads work at times, but those flaws are in the minuscule percentage compared to the manipulation and damage you can do by transformation of digital data. Digital data you can make zero or a million instantaneously. You'll never know.
Have you ever heard of, in your travels, have you ever heard of people bragging or talking about manipulating votes electronically?
I've watched many people do many kinds of hacks to see if they work.
All right. Thank you very much.
Generally, because you got to understand, I've been so public about the fact of this for so long. If I'm in the room, there's not a lot of people that are going to say, I was involved in that vote.
Since you've kind of come out publicly about this, have you caught...
I was public about it before anyone even knew what a voting machine was.
Have you caught any heat, any pressure?
Yes.
I mean, have they asked you to be quiet
yes.
and not talk about this?
Yes.
And do you think that's because... They have something to hide?
Yes. Now, of course, the explanation is always, you are reducing America's assurance in our voting system. I said, correct! Because there is no assurance in this voting system. And they're like, but people will doubt their vote. I said, they should! It's being stolen!
Is anybody saying to you, hey, Steve, you know, you're a Republican, the Democrats stole elections back in the 60s or
yes,
whatever, and this is payback, and we're better at this or anything like that?
As I had a very good friend who worked in a senior position in this administration who said, and I paraphrase slightly out of respect to him, he says, it's just a different methodology. It's like, Daley got us in 64. It's even.
So, they're better at it now.
Except, as I repeatedly said, 62, sorry, Mr. Daley. As I've repeatedly said, the problem is you think you control this genie, and you don't. You've built a hackable system, and there's hundreds of sharks who all want to hack it. And you will not know who the final hacker was. Great, let's see three or four groups trying to... You know something? The whole point is we don't know anymore. We don't know. I want to know who won. I don't mind losing, but I want the game to be fair. I want the vote to be counted. I want to live in a democracy. It's not that complicated.
Do you believe that the target now is a very small subset of swing states or even counties within those swing states?
The target, as far as I can tell, has always been the same from the beginning. It's a Supreme Court that will overturn Roe v. Wade. When you look at which votes are hacked and why, it's either to affect the Judiciary Committees or the Executive to make sure that agenda wins in the long run. And the people I believe are most involved in it think very long term, and that is the goal.
GOP cyber expert Stephen Spoonamore, interviewed in mid-September by Velvet Revolution. This entire interview has been posted on YouTube, and you can access those links and other related information on the web at velvetrevolution.us. velvetrevolution.us. Last week, we began Chapter 10 in our ongoing reading of the 2006 book, Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, an MD and psychotherapist whose experience led her to conclude that social equality is necessary for human health. This chapter is titled Blame the Victim, and last week's reading covered the program by the wealthy to blame those they exploit for their miserable condition, including attempts to scientifically, quote, prove that poverty is the result of genetic inferiority and the accompanying eugenics movement designed to weed out so-called inferior people from the gene pool in the national interest. This material was also covered in our previous reading from John Taylor Gatto's book a couple of years ago, The Underground History of American Education. Last week, Rosenthal wrote how after the Nazi extermination program was revealed in its horror in the West after the war, eugenics in America, which was the inspiration for the Nazis in the 1930s, was discredited, and its proponents remade themselves as advocates of population control. Prior to resuming reading, I need for the first time to take exception to Rosenthal's analysis in the section to come. She has been making the case that chronic starvation in the world is not a result of too many people, rather too little equality. That is true. We presently produce enough food which, if equally distributed, would end starvation. But there is more in my view to the story of human population than whether the planet can produce enough food. The excess in human population and our food production and habitations have destroyed the habitats of other creatures who are dying out in droves. And that's not even addressing human-caused climate disruption. Every grassland or forest plowed up for agriculture represents habitat loss for other species, which also form an important and beautiful part of life on this planet. A major reason 90% of the large fish in the ocean are gone is because of overfishing for human consumption. There are way too many of us, and we would all live a better life by drastically reducing childbearing for a few generations. Rosenthal asserts that the claim that there are too many people must result in us cheering genocide and disasters. No, it doesn't. We can cheer when we hear of a place population is decreasing due to a lower birth rate. With that said, I'll resume reading the objectionable words in an otherwise exemplary book. Too many people? Today, sections of the environmental movement continue to promote the false doctrine of overpopulation. The website of Support a Comprehensive Sierra Club Population Policy, SUSPS, states, "Unending population growth and increasing levels of consumption together are the root causes of the vast majority of our environmental problems." This is a dangerous argument. If you believe that too many people are destroying the planet, then you would have to cheer every famine, war, flood, and earthquake that reduced the population. You would also have to welcome diseases that kill millions every year. Contrary to popular belief, environmental destruction is not caused by too many people on the planet. Environmental damage is accelerating despite falling global birth rates. Between 1970 and 2000, the fertility rate in the world's poor nations dropped more than half, from 6.2 down to 3. In Europe, the fertility rate has fallen to 1.4, which is below replacement level. The United States has the greatest impact on the environment, yet its fertility rate has been below the replacement level for the past 3 decades. Excuse me for breaking in, but I have to comment on this. I assume you've seen the fallacy in this statistic. While the birth rate may have declined for the past 3 decades, the U.S. population has increased in absolute numbers every decade. In 1970, it was approximately 213,300,000. By the 2000 census, it had risen to 291,400,000, approximately, an increase of about 78 million people in 3 decades. If the average lifespan is 75 years, even if there were no additional increases from immigration, the reduction in birth rate would not lead to population reduction in 3 decades. China has attempted to limit population growth by law for 3 decades, and the birth rate has been cut in half and then by 2/3 in that time, according to government statistics. Nevertheless, the population is still growing by 10 million people each year. There are 6 billion people on this planet. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, there were 1.5 billion, a number the ecosystem can comfortably support without the inputs of fossil fuel that have enabled people to live at densities and in locations that cannot ecologically support their populations without the importation of food and water, dangerous levels of deforestation, or the depletion of aquifers. In his interview, Derek Jensen spoke of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days when they migrated, of rivers so full of salmon they would capsize a boat. Others have written of schools of whales so large that mariners could smell their breath, of forests so vast a squirrel could cross the North American continent by hopping from tree to tree. If I could bequeath a gift to the people of the future, it would be to give them a world like that, a world I've never seen and never will see. I grew up in a land of freeways and housing tracts. They called it progress, the promised land. To me, it was hell, and I headed every chance I got for the beaches, the canyons, the mountains, the deserts, places since overrun with more housing tracts from their stupid housing bubble, now deflating. Of all the dangerous and stupid profit orgies of American capitalism, that is the worst. The damage done by that goes beyond financial loss and foreclosures. The damage done to the land will take 10 generations to undo. These demons roam the land looking for places to destroy in the name of economic growth. When will this destruction of beauty and wonder stop? Where trees once reached for the sky and birds sang in their branches, now are parking lots littered with the wrappers of Little Debbie snack cakes. How can anyone bear that? Why do we put up with that? But anyway, continuing. There are several reasons for declining fertility. More people are moving from rural to urban centers. Rural families benefit from more children helping on the farm. Rural families benefit from more children helping on the farm, while urban families can achieve higher living standards by having fewer children. Also, women who gain access to education and jobs have fewer children. Poverty is not caused by people having too many children. People have more children when they are poor. Malthus was also wrong about hunger being the result of too many people and not enough food. There is only one reason people go hungry. There is only one reason people go hungry. Food is produced for profit, not for need. We can produce enough to feed twice the number of people living on the planet, but if all that food came to market, the price of food would plummet. To keep prices high, states restrict food production or keep what is produced off the market. To keep farmers on the land, they are paid not to produce. The ridiculous result is that some people pay inflated food prices and higher taxes for farm subsidies, while others cannot afford to eat at all. In India, where more than half the children are malnourished, the state spends more to stockpile food than it does to feed the hungry. People are not the problem. Environmental destruction is caused by social policies that put profit first. It is profitable to pillage natural resources and to use the environment as a dumping ground. The belief that social and environmental problems are caused by too many people persists, not because it is true, but because it serves the ruling class. Part 4 explains how production could be reorganized to meet the needs of people and the environment. The twin myths of scarcity and overpopulation provide the false explanations for class inequality. The more the majority can be convinced to tighten their belts, the more the elite can stuff under theirs. Malthusian lies make the unacceptable seem inevitable. Beggars on the streets of the world's most prosperous cities, millions starving while mountains of food are left to rot, people dying because medicines are priced out of reach, one part of the population being overworked, while the other part is desperate for work, obscene wealth growing alongside desperate poverty. Class struggle. The war between the classes is conducted in two dimensions. In the material realm, the capitalist class extracts surplus from a working class that resists exploitation. In the realm of ideas, the doctrines of the capitalist class do battle with opposing ideas. For capitalism to survive, the capitalist class must dominate both dimensions. Opposition to the ruling class and its ideas ebbs and flows, depending on the relative strength of the opposing classes. During the 1950s, the ruling class was more confident and smashed the opposition and its ideas. During the 1960s, the working class pushed back, challenging the ruling class and its ideas. Over the past few decades, the ruling class has taken back the ground it lost during the 1960s and strengthened ideas that blame the victim. To win the next round, we need to understand how we lost the last one. After World War II, Black American veterans believed they had earned the right to equality at home. Over the next two decades, their struggle for civil rights merged with other struggles to form a general working-class rebellion. During the 1960s, millions of Americans demanded racial equality, women's liberation, Aboriginal rights, gay liberation, safer conditions at work, more affordable housing, better schools, and more access to medical care. There was an organized opposition to poverty, pollution, nuclear power, the arms race, the death penalty, and U.S. foreign policy. A massive anti-war movement challenged U.S. imperialism, and American cities were shaken by Black rebellions. The belief that ordinary people could change the world was in the air, and it was intoxicating. support for capitalism was cracking in the heart of the system. The ruling class fought back on two fronts, granting limited reforms to promote confidence in the system and moving to crush the opposition. Let's look at the reforms first. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson announced a war on poverty and launched social programs like Head Start, food stamps, Medicare, and Medicaid. Passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act made it easier for black people to vote. The Civil Rights Act made racial discrimination illegal. To counter past discrimination, affirmative action policies set aside some jobs, admission to higher education, and other opportunities for members of oppressed groups. In 1967, a moratorium was placed on executions. That same year, the Supreme Court ruled that children had the right to due process. In 1973, women won the legal right to abortion. In 1970, Congress enacted the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, to improve workplace health and safety. All over the country, employers raised wages and benefits. These social improvements were no act of charity. They were won by masses of people who fought and died for them. The ruling class also met the call for social justice with repression. Civil rights demonstrators were attacked with water hoses, dogs, clubs, and guns. Black churches were bombed, and civil rights workers were murdered. Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965, and Martin Luther King was killed 3 years later. Between 1967 and 1968, dozens of leading members of the Black Panther Party were imprisoned and murdered. Chicago police viciously attacked demonstrators during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Deadly force was used to suppress anti-war campus protests. In 1970, the National Guard killed 4 students at Kent State University and wounded 9 others. At Jackson State University, police killed 2 students and wounded 12 others. Despite reforms and repression, the social crisis deepened. The U.S. was losing the war in Vietnam. The North Vietnamese forces refused to be beaten, and the American people had turned against the war, and the U.S. Army was in revolt. The Watergate scandal exposed the corruption at the heart of the system. In 1973, the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam. In 1974, President Nixon resigned in disgrace. That same year, the economy went into recession. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The Employer's Offensive. Battered by social protest, imperial defeat, and economic crisis, the capitalist class was desperate to restore its credibility and its profitability. In 1972, the heads of major U.S. corporations organized a business roundtable to, quote, enable chief executives from different corporations to work together, close quote, to influence public policy. Founders of the Business Roundtable included the chief executives of Alcoa, General Electric, and U.S. Steel. In 1974, Business Week described the difficulty of their task, quote, it will be a hard pill for many Americans to swallow. The idea of doing with less so business can have more. Nothing that this nation or any other nation has done in modern economic history compares in difficulty with the selling job that must be done to make people accept the new reality, close quote. And sell they did. Through newspapers, magazines, radio and television stations, book publishers and movie studios, the new reality was called neoliberalism or trickle-down economics. The plan was for workers to accept less in the present in order to build the economy, which would then reward them with higher living standards in the future. This was not a new idea. In 1961, President Kennedy had claimed that a rising tide would raise all boats. It was pure PR, designed to get the majority to back the goals of the ruling class. It was also a lie. Under capitalism, wealth produced at the bottom flows up. It never trickles down. As one chorus, the ruling class touted economic growth as the best way, the only way, to solve social problems. However, neoliberalism was never about solving social problems. It was the beginning of a one-sided class war to restore the power and profitability of American capitalism. This war had two fronts: to restructure the economy in favor of the capitalist class, and to undercut resistance by blaming the victim. The more that ordinary people blame themselves and each other for social problems, the less they would challenge the system. By the late 1970s, the employers' offensive was in full swing. To restructure the economy, governments gave massive tax cuts to corporate America and removed many of the restrictions on business that had protected workers and the environment. Deregulation and, quote, downsizing spelled the end of hundreds of thousands of good jobs. Employers demanded concession contracts to roll back wages and benefits they had previously granted. Union-busting companies proliferated. In 1980 alone, the National Labor Relations Board reinstated 10,000 workers who had been illegally fired for union organizing. The massive upward transfer of wealth caused the 1980s to be known as the looting decade, which was followed by the even greater plunder of the 1990s. Between 1981 and 2000, the average annual compensation of the 10 highest-paid executives in the United States soared from just under $4 million to $154 million. A rising economic tide was lifting the yachts by sinking the rowboats. Never before had real wages fallen while the economy was booming. Life for ordinary people became harder and meaner. Someone had to take the blame for falling living standards, and it was not going to be the capitalist class. Assault on the poor. The second front of the employer's offensive was to blame the victim. Blaming the victim shifts criticism away from unjust social policies and onto the victims of those policies. Victim blaming also makes it easier to transfer tax revenue from social programs into the pockets of the rich. During the 1960s, right-wing groups and individuals pumped out blame the victim propaganda. However, pressure from social movements kept these ideas on the fringe of society. The employer's offensive brought them back into the mainstream. When Charles Murray wrote Losing Ground to attack social welfare programs, the ruling class embraced it as gospel. President Ronald Reagan concocted the outrageous myth that women on welfare were living high off the hog, wearing fur coats and driving Cadillac cars. As the media jumped on the poor-bashing bandwagon, the image of the welfare queen became a symbol of the undeserving poor. In 1994, the bell curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life, became a bestseller. Reviving Malthus equations, authors Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein claim that the growing gap between classes is caused by smarter people rising to the top of society, marrying each other and having even smarter children, while duller people fall to the bottom of society, marry each other and have even duller children. The authors conclude that social resources should be shifted away from those at the bottom of society who will always be dull and poor to the better off who have better prospects of fulfilling their potential. The bell curve contained hundreds of pages of scientific-looking charts and graphs, all bogus. Like Losing Ground, the bell curve was Malthusian propaganda masquerading as science. That suited the ruling class just fine, and Murray was invited to address the House of Representatives. Another book, Inequality by Design, demolished every argument in the bell curve. However, its authors were not invited to address Congress. Politicians embraced the bell curve because it suited their slash-and-burn approach to social programs. The extent of inequality is determined by the balance of class forces, not by biology. The rebellions of the 1960s raised the standard of living so that by 1969, income inequality fell to a post-war low. In the 1970s, the employers' offensive drove down the standard of living of working people and caused inequality to rise again. Today, the gap between the super-rich and everyone else is greater than ever. People don't accept being robbed easily. The ruling class needs some way to keep the growing numbers of poor and angry people under control. The injustice system. The prisoner is the visible symbol of crime contained, the criminal caged and restrained, to give the unwitting citizen the feeling that the cops and jails are preserving his safety. William Ryan. Everyone wants justice and everyone wants to feel safe. Unfortunately, human needs are irrelevant to the, quote, justice system. Defense attorney Clarence Darrow explains, quote, a jail is evidence of the lack of charity of the people on the outside who make the jails and fill them with the victims of their greed. Those men who own the earth make the laws to protect what they have. They fix up a sort of fence or pen around what they have, and they fix the law so the fellow on the other side cannot get in. The laws are really organized for the men who rule the world. They were never organized or enforced to do justice. We have no system for justice, not the slightest in the world. Close quote. The, quote, justice system exists to legalize the crimes of capitalism, class inequality, and deprivation. It is perfectly legal for the capitalist class to commit theft by taking what workers produce, to assault workers to raise productivity, and to commit murder through wars of acquisition. Crime is defined in ways that target the working class. If you take something from your workplace, that is considered stealing. If the power company raises its rates every month, that is considered business. In 2006, Las Vegas declared it a crime to feed homeless people in public parks. Failing to provide housing for the homeless, jobs for the jobless, medicine for the sick, and food for the hungry are not considered crimes. Governments and corporations can legally withhold life's essentials from those who cannot pay. Parents who treated their children this way would be thrown in jail. In The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Prison, Jeffrey Ryman calculates that corporate crime costs ordinary people far more money and causes many more deaths than common street crimes. Executives market dangerous and defective products like the Ford Pinto. Manufacturers dump toxic chemicals into the environment. Managers destroy jobs to raise profits. And drug company barons price medicines out of reach. Unlike many murderers sitting in prison for life, these gentlemen bandits, these intelligent, educated men and women who slowly and methodically plan the crimes that wreck the future of untold numbers of people, know exactly what they are doing and who will be hurt. Their crimes of cold, selfish greed reflect in their own way even more indifference to life than murder. Close quote. Darrow defined a criminal as a person with predatory instincts who has not sufficient capital to form a corporation. Those who do form corporations can ignore the law. General Electric has been convicted of 282 counts of contract fraud, and not a single GE executive sits in jail. A common criminal with 282 convictions would be incarcerated for life. Under California's three strikes law, Gary Ewing was sentenced to 25 years in prison for stealing three golf clubs, and Leandro Andrade was sentenced to 50 years in prison for stealing nine children's videotapes. The definition of violence also serves the system. If you kill someone, it's called murder. If the state kills someone, it's called justice. Politicians who demand that we get tough on crime never talk about cracking down on the causes of crime because the class system is the cause of crime. The poorest neighborhoods have similar high murder rates, whether they are predominantly black, white, or Hispanic. Drug addiction, prostitution, theft, assault, and murder are the result of no jobs, no money, no future, and no hope. A 2004 national survey of American cities revealed a direct relationship between deprivation, unemployment, less education, and lower income, and serious crime, including murder, rape, and robbery. The safest city was Newton, Massachusetts, and the most dangerous city was Camden, Pennsylvania. Newton's employment rate was more than five times higher than Camden's. More than two-thirds of Newton residents had a university degree, compared with only 5% of Camden residents. And the median household income in Newton was more than three times that of Camden's. The real crime in Camden is deprivation. If Camden residents had the same living standards as Newton residents, they would enjoy the same low crime rates. The violence that capitalism perpetrates is perfectly legal. In contrast, rebellion against injustice is not tolerated. As a result, prisons are filled with the victims of the greedy people who run society. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The world's biggest jailer. The fuse of America's prison explosion was lit in the late 1960s. With a war raging in Vietnam, riots sweeping major cities, and protests roiling college campuses, Congress responded with a major anti-crime bill that doled out millions of dollars to local police and increased the federal government's involvement in local law enforcement. Crime had never been much of an issue in federal politics before, but Richard Nixon made it a central campaign theme that year. In 1971, President Nixon announced that the nation's greatest problem was illegal drug use, not the poverty and desperation that caused people to use drugs. The subsequent war on drugs was a war on the poor in disguise. Previous administrations had sterilized the poor and left them to die from preventable diseases. The Nixon administration launched a campaign to imprison them in record numbers. In 1973, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller dramatically raised the penalties for drug offenses so that anyone caught selling 1 ounce of narcotics or possessing 2 ounces would get an automatic minimum sentence of 15 years in prison. Elaine Bartlett, a 26-year-old mother of 4 young children, was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison for her first offense, selling 4 ounces of cocaine. To those who moralize that Brown shouldn't have sold drugs, reggae artist Bounty Killer replies, "We do what we do so we stay alive. We sell what we sell because we want to survive." Mass incarceration went hand in hand with the assault on the gangs of the 1960s. Troublemakers could be locked up. The victims of heartless social policies could be painted as dangerous instead of deprived. A population that feared the criminal next door would be more willing to back the criminals in power. In 1976, the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty, and over the next 30 years, more than 1,000 people were executed by the state. All were poor, and almost all were people of color. Anti-drug laws and longer sentences filled America's prisons. Between 1970 and 2001, the national crime rate did not rise, yet the number of people in prison exploded from 200,000 to over 2 million. Most of them nonviolent drug offenders. By 2001, the Rockefeller drug laws had resulted in an additional 325,000 person years of incarceration in New York State alone. Those years of life lost to prison were equivalent to 9,848 deaths, or more than 3 times the losses suffered in the bombing of the World Trade Center. I've been reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with Chapter 10 next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.